Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 303 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. How are you this evening?
Doing awesome. Glad to be with you again, as usual.
It's a very short list, and, well, you were at the bottom, but you're the only one that answers calls.
I'm not surprised. The last person answered their phone died about 20 years ago.
I called somebody today, Larry, and they answered the phone.
That's shocking.
Chance, how are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to be here.
Welcome back. Any exciting legal stuff to quickly summarize that you've had to deal with this week?
I would talk about it, but I'd immediately be killed. So I'm gonna remain silent.
All right then. Why isn't my rotating screen thing doing? Let's see here. We should probably make sure that you like, subscribe, hit all those fancy buttons that do all the things, and leave reviews. It really does help. At least that's what they tell me it does. And the best thing that you could do is share it. Tell somebody you know that you like this podcast. It's great. You could even tell them you hate it. Don't do that. And so, Larry, what are we going to do this episode?
Not very much.
All right, then. Good night.
We don't have any cases to review, so we plan to cover listener questions and comments, a couple of articles, and a California corner with Chance Oberstein. And the letter from Daniel, one of the letters we're covering, will be very, very interesting since it's about polygraphs, which is your favorite.
It is one of my favorites, for sure.
And then there was a two-part question, and we're going to save that second part for next episode. And the second letter from Mark is a comment about my wonderful sense of humor that you don't agree with, so I can't help myself. I have to put that in there. Somebody at least thinks I'm funny. And now that in of itself is funny. Can't you agree?
Definitely.
Oh, yeah. Funny. Oh, yeah.
So, all righty. Well, we got this listener comment that you put through ChatGPT, so we had to reduce it because it was too excessively long. We apologize if we've distorted it too much, but we're trying to save time. So go ahead.
Just for clarity, it's GPT, not B.
Okay.
It's not Georgia Public or whatever. Anyway, I recently contacted the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, the GBI, after receiving a second harassing scam call at my workplace, the company's store I manage. The scammer, posing as quote-unquote Lieutenant Ross, used the National Sex Offender Registry to target me, claiming I was under investigation and needed to contact them immediately. Despite our strict company policy against sharing personal information, they used my work address listed on the registry to impersonate law enforcement and attempt extortion by demanding payment for a fictitious bond. This is not the first time I've been targeted. The same individual attempted a similar scam over a year ago. These incidents are extremely distressing, affecting both my family and my efforts to rehabilitate and reintegrate into society after my conviction. Although I acknowledge the importance of the registry for public safety, can we put an asterisk by that just because we recognize it? It should not facilitate intimidation and exploitation. I have maintained compliance with all registration requirements, striving to live as a law-abiding citizen and community leader. However, the misuse of registry information for scams undermines my rehabilitation and poses a significant threat. I urge the GBI to address the misuse and protect individuals like myself from such fraudulent activities. Thank you for attention to this serious matter.
I put this in here even though it was long because I wanted to clarify, and I checked with people who are and have been registered in the state of Georgia, and they do not list employment on the Georgia PFR registry. And this writer is referring to the national registry. And first of all, there is no national registry. There's a national search tool, and it merely looks into the state registries. So I can assure you of this. If Georgia is not listing your employer on the registry public facing, then the national registry would not have that information because all it is a tool to tunnel in from a central source. So if that person receives a call at their job, that's very distressing, because as Andy and I were chatting about this during the week, that would almost suggest that there is a penetration of the secrecy of law enforcement, because that information wouldn't be on the website.
I would argue, Larry, it's an inside job. I would argue that it's friends, family, or even law enforcement themselves doing it. Because, you know, I got one of those calls once, and it is incredibly convincing what they're up to. They have radio chatter going on, like, in the background of there being police traffic, and they'll almost, like, move their hand away from the phone for a moment, and they'll talk on the radio, talking back to command center, whatever. It's incredibly convincing.
Well, I remember when you got that call, and it was very convincing and distressing to you. But he's got to run a deeper investigation, because unless Georgia has changed what they're doing and listing this information publicly, the national search engine wouldn't find it, because it just follows what's the, you do the search on the national website and it takes you to the states where that individual with that name is registered, and it looks into their registry. It doesn't create information that's not already there.
And it would be pretty challenging. Who else would know? It would be challenging for them to have, quote unquote, the national registry that says that you work at Waffle House on 123 Main Street, and they would have the phone number for the Waffle House. The people that would have that would be your handlers. That's the people that would, and not even the phone number probably, they would certainly know that you work at Waffle House 123 Main Street, and perhaps they have your supervisor's name.
Well, that's very distressing to me, because he had to deal with something that may have or might cause his termination. No one wants to deal with that, that's running a business with phone calls related to the PFR registration status. That's horrible. But I don't know what to suggest. I mean, maybe our attorney might have some suggestion for him, but I don't know what to suggest, because how the heck do you figure out who did it?
Well, we probably don't have enough information to do that anyway, because, you know, when these things happen subjectively, you know, we get into fear mode, and sometimes we forget what we've done. Sometimes we need to check our social histories, our, you know, what we do on the internet, where information is about us. I mean, often anyone could Google someone and find out all kinds of things they didn't even realize were out there, or were put out there, or they put out there, or whatever. And so, you know, the first place you start is what's out there about you anyway. And then you kind of whittle it down until you get to the point where either you can't figure it out, or, hey, this little fact came out, and unfortunately it's there, and what do I do about it?
Indeed, and that's a good point, because I've known people, particularly youngsters, that don't have any life experience to guide them about the fear of private information becoming public. I remember a kid that I knew put his picture of his driver's license on his Facebook page, and I said, you ought to pull that down. I mean, I said, you've given people a whole lot of information about you that you wouldn't want the whole world to be able to access. But he was proud about his driver's license.
Certainly. But you could redact the crap out of it and not just put the thing out there naked, so to speak.
He had the entire license without any redaction.
Jesus. License number and everything. Full address, everything. Phone number, eye color. Good grief, man.
Everything.
Well, anything else here?
Good luck to this guy, because I can imagine how disturbing this would be.
Totally. All right, well, then this one is a letter from Daniel, correct?
That is correct, with a two-part question. We're going to divide one this and another on another episode.
Very good. It says, I am writing about two separate issues questions. So we're only going to cover the first one, as Larry said. In episode 299, you discussed polygraphs. I'd like to share my experience with the polygraph. The authorities involved, PO, which I could be police officer, but I think it's probation officer, judge, etc., most definitely believe in them and treat them as if they are infallible science. We, of course, know better. The polygrapher told me I failed, but I did not believe him. So I asked to see the charts, and he said he cannot share them due to policy. My PO then got involved, and ultimately I was taken into custody that day for refusing to consent to a search. I never refused the search. That was one of the many lies the PO made up. The next day, the PO searched my house. It did not have any prohibited items. However, I did have a book written about the polygraph, antipolygraph.org. Once he found the book, he then added a violation for attempting to manipulate the polygraph. I am innocent of both violations, but the judge ruled guilty and sentenced me to 12 months. I had an appeal, but my former worthless court-appointed lawyer filed an Anders brief and then quit. My sentence will be complete before any appeal. My biggest concern is about all the lies and false information submitted by this PO, which my lawyer never even tried to contest. Any suggestions on what I should do? Larry, there's tons of stuff. We should just let Chance go at it.
Oh, no, no. I'd say Larry first. Go ahead, Larry. Take a shot.
Oh, well, in terms of the Anders brief, I will defer if you're going to expand on what that is. I've never written one, but I'm familiar with the term. But when your probation is revoked, we typically don't refer to that as being found guilty, because the violations, unless you've been charged with a crime, which also can constitute a violation of supervision, the technical violations are not criminal acts. They result in an additional potential incarceration period, but the evidentiary standard is much lower, the rules of evidence is much lower, the admissibility of evidence is virtually almost anything is competent evidence in a revocation hearing. It's hard to keep anything out. And having that book in my state would have been very troubling for any court. Now, that doesn't mean that I agree with it, but it would be very troubling if you're in a regimen that requires that you go through polygraph examinations and they find guides on how to circumvent those maintenance examinations. The judge here, any judge here that I can think of, would not think that's very funny. But in terms of what to undo, how to undo it, if the sanction he got is relatively short, I think it said 12 months, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, 12 months. By the time you get your appeal up and running, you've already exhausted the 12 months. So it's a very difficult situation. I would say don't do anything of that nature again when you get out, because even if you were to prevail on appeal, you've already done the time. Go ahead, Chance.
Right.
Did we lose Chance?
You know what? I'm just thinking about this. And first of all, I'm not familiar with an Anders brief. What state is this?
I don't think he said.
Yeah,
I don't see anywhere that says where he is.
I can't see that. But here's my thinking on it, and this is more of a California type thinking on it. And you know, Larry described, of course, and was accurate. Same in California. It's not, you know, it's not a newly charged crime. It's an allegation of a violation, which is a much lower threshold. So it's a problem. But you know, if you have an attorney and that attorney believes in your cause and is willing to bat for you in this case. And again, it's in California, it's very easy to find the violation. But if you get some latitude in it, you might want to ask for a stay, you know, pending appeal. You know, that's, and of course, you know, you've got to have some, you know, firepower, some equities built up here. You really have to have this thing, you know, settled out in terms of, you know, what the law is and, it is a very fine line, very fine line. And so this is a tough thing to defend. It's just very, very, very tough these days with these tests and, you know, trying to prepare yourself for them and things like that. This sounds just pretty awful to me.
Let me just back up. He is in Ohio. He is in the Northern District of Ohio.
Yeah, that's what I thought, because, you know, I've never heard of an Anders brief before. So, yeah. And it says here, you know, well, anyways, I'm not even going to try to guess what an Anders brief is, but the biggest problem is that his lawyer quit. And that's and that pretty much sunk everything. And you would think that if his lawyer quit, he'd be able to get another lawyer, someone appointed that would take up where the other guy left off, or whatever, a conflict lawyer, whatever it was, whatever the reason why the lawyer quit, you know, and a determination on, you know, who's going to be the next one to step in. But that shouldn't leave him alone and having to defend the self on his own.
So, yeah, I'm not going to try to explain Anders either, because that didn't come up in prep, but I do remember something about it in terms of counsel withdrawing and a brief supposed to be put in. And I think it goes back to a Supreme Court decision from the 60s. But man, that's been a long time ago, probably back in a liberal heyday of Earl Warren. But yeah, like I said, I'm not going to give my detractor a chance to say I'm giving frivolous information, because I'm not really up to speed on Anders.
Well, I can tell you what it says about it real quick. So I'm reading from information from the internet. An Anders brief is a type of legal document submitted by an appointed attorney in a criminal case who believes that an appeal would be frivolous. It originates from a U.S. Supreme Court case, Anders versus, hey, Chance, California. In that decision, the court established that if a court-appointed lawyer finds no meritorious grounds for appeal after a diligent review of the case, they can submit this brief to request permission to withdraw from representation.
Wow. Yeah, I've never heard anybody doing that in California at all. You know, zero. So, but it is interesting if you think about it. That may be the problem with this whole claim here is, you know, maybe legal counsel looked at it and came to that conclusion, and that's the way it goes there. I'm not familiar with Ohio's procedure. I've never heard that happening in California.
Well,
sure.
If that person had contacted this office, they probably wouldn't get past screening, because I would have the same reaction as I explained and you expanded on. The evidentiary standard is so low in a revocation. And it's basically, if you have a scale, the preponderance of the evidence is what you're looking for in a probation violation. You've already been granted mercy by not being incarcerated. So it doesn't take the same standard to take that privilege away from you. If it did, no one would ever be granted probation. So therefore, if he had called here and said, oh, well, all I did was have a guide on beating the polygraph and the probation officer violated me for that, I would say, well, you know, we'll take your case, but I'm not sure we're going to gain any traction with that, because the judges are going to look very unfavorably on that, regardless of which judge you have. And therefore, they're likely to uphold the action and revoke your supervision, agree with the PO and revoke your supervision for a period of time. And it appears as that's what they did. So he's concerned about all the lies and stuff that we're told. And that's common in this business. When you're on probation, these are not people who've been appointed to the priesthood and the sainthood that you're dealing with. Some of them are very, very honest, but some of them will cut any corner to achieve their goal. When you have that in mind, you realize that you're going to have to play extra diligent by the rules and not give them anything.
Go back. You said they're going to do to achieve their goal. They'll do anything to achieve their goal. What is their goal?
Well, it varies from case to case. If the probation officer has someone that they, in their mind, think didn't get a sufficient punishment, they should have never been given probation, their goal in that particular case may be to see to it that you see the inside of a prison. And their goal in that case would be to revoke you. They don't want to revoke everybody. If you think about it, if a probation officer had zero success rate, you would have to take a look at, well, this probation officer, why is it that no one makes it through? So they don't want to revoke everybody. But in this particular case, they may have wanted to revoke this person.
Do you, the way you just worded that though, Larry, makes it sound like there's some kind of performance review at the end of the, you know, every 6 months or something like that, that people have at big companies. Now here, Mr. Jones, you haven't had any successful transitions off of probation. We're going to send you to further training. I don't see that environment in the handler department.
Well, I don't know if it's quite that blatant, but think about it. If you set a probation system up, the goal would not be to revoke everyone. There would be no point whatsoever in having probation if that was the goal, was to get everyone in prison. So it stands to reason that there would be some examination of a probation officer who has continuous failures and nobody ever gets through it. You'd like to think, in an ideal world, that someone would look at that and say, well, wow, I've looked at, you've had 123 people assigned to you in the year and a half you've been here, and not a soul has made it without a violation. I'd like to think that that would come up in a discussion.
Sure.
But I haven't worked in that system directly, but I would assume that it would.
I thought you'd worked everywhere.
Not quite. I mean, I've only had since 1841 to do this stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, he's old. Chance, you think you're old. He's got you beat by triple.
I don't think so. I think we're just about the same.
Shh, don't tell him.
But I'll tell you one thing, though, about what I'm thinking about this whole thing. And I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, you know, one, he failed the test. And again, it's not a measure of whether or not you're telling the truth or not. It's a measure of, you know, whether you get nervous when they ask you about something. And, you know, it gives a probation officer or parole officer cause maybe think that you're hiding something. So you get a search. And during the search, they find a book about polygraphs. And, you know, you've got someone who, one, is suspecting that you're hiding something, and two, is putting two and two together, which might not equal four, but in their mind it does, and you've got a problem. So there is a moral to this story, and I think Larry hit it on the nose, and that is, you know, make sure that you play by the rules, and you know, you've got a sterile environment when they come to search your house.
100%.
And they are likely to intensify supervision if you show deception on that polygraph. You might as well plan for that. Don't doubt us on if you are reported to have failed a polygraph test. They can't revoke you for that alone, but they can intensify supervision and find something else to revoke you for, which is what they did.
Moving along. This next one is a letter from Mark. It says, I received your April 12th letter on, April 22nd, regarding my donation and how to utilize it. Let's do this. Put however much towards 12 months of receiving the transcript until May 1st of 2025. Then please use the balance in whatever way is most useful to sustain the transcript service, because the transcript service is really important to me. And I want to do whatever I can to keep it going. So paying your transcriptionist, office supplies, postage, etc. And because there cannot be a transcript without a podcast, I don't mind if you apply it towards podcast costs as well. Like Geritol for Larry. I'm in favor of this. All in favor of Geritol for Larry, say aye. And a sense of humor for Andy. Yes, absurd laws are funny. Or, as you mentioned, a case of beer for the staff. If you guys are he wrote 401C3, but 501C3? That's what we are, right, Larry?
Correct.
Yeah, so 501C3 nonprofit. Could you send me an official thank you for your tax-deductible donation letter? If not, well. Yes, I am now caught up on transcripts. The mailroom in this place is hardcore. I tried sending you some stamps back in December. They would not let me. Hopefully there will be more dollars to come after the judge denies their second motion for summary judgment, or grants mine, or I win my second appeal, etc. I'm surprised they are willing to drag this out. Clearly, their attorneys are salary and not hourly. Thank you for your help. Cordially.
Well, I appreciate that, Mark, and we do intend to send you a thank you letter officially so that tax deductibility is there for anyone who wants to donate to FYP Education. That is a great option for you if you're looking for a tax deductible vehicle. Why not use FYP?
I concur. That was the stimulus money, right?
That is correct. No one's done that yet, but if anybody has $1,400 left over, feel free to dump it in FYP Education. and thank you, Mark. That was extremely generous of what you sent to us. That'll carry us for a little while, and we appreciate it.
All right. Chance, your turn. Take it away, sir.
Okay. I put this in here because there was some confusion about it last time around, and I want to clarify some things. I've been getting some calls, texts, emails about certificates of rehabilitation. I can't even say it, but yeah. So that's what it's going to be. It's going to be certificate of rehabilitation. This is going to be the first installment. There will be a second one, but the first one is going to be simply to just maybe clarify some stuff about it. So if you guys want to jump in at any point, please feel free. And I'll start right here. You know, people are asking, what's the difference between a certificate of rehabilitation and termination of sex registration? Aren't they both the same? Do I need both? And let's just clarify that for a minute. A termination under Penal Code Section 290.5 terminates the obligation to register and removes you from the California Sex Registry. It says nothing about rehabilitation. It just simply does that. In this state, and you know, in California, we have another thing. And for those who have been convicted of either a felony or specific sex crimes, and that is a certificate of rehabilitation. And this is a court order that says someone who was, one, convicted of a felony, and two, served time in state or local prison, has been rehabilitated. Completely different from being removed. Okay, it does not erase your criminal record, but it can have some benefits. And this is why it's really good. For example, it may help you when you're applying for a job or professional license from the state. Let me just dive into this a little bit deeper. There are laws about when an employer can ask about or consider related to your criminal history when you apply for a job. One of these laws is called the, believe it or not, Fair Chance Act. Don't laugh. That's the name of it.
You wrote this for you.
I didn't, but I was quite shocked when I read it. Anyway, in California, most employers can't ask about your criminal history before they're making you a conditional job offer. After making you an offer, they can do a criminal history check and ask about your convictions. But they can't ask about or consider convictions that have been expunged, sealed, dismissed, or statutorily eradicated. They also can't consider convictions for which you've received a certificate, rehabilitation, or pardon in this state. Now, this law does not apply to all employers or all jobs. For example, the law doesn't apply to employers with less than 5 employees. It also doesn't apply to jobs where the employer is required to restrict employment based on criminal history or do a background check. For example, certain jobs in healthcare, banking, education, or law enforcement. And for those who are interested in this and want to see, you know, a little bit more in this area because they're considering it, more information can be found at the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing. And other laws may apply to your situation. And, you know, one of the things I always say is, if you don't know, talk to a lawyer about it. And that would be really good in this area right here. But in general, and I'm talking about certificates of rehabilitation, in general, rehabilitation means that for many years after your conviction, you've lived an honest and upright life, followed the law, and showed good moral character. And that can be found at Penal Code Section 4852.05. That's the standard. Now, also, another benefit is it's a good first step to applying to the governor for a pardon. And I'm not pushing pardons here, folks, because you know, I've never heard of one granted with respect to a sex crime conviction, but it is the first step, and short of the pardon, there are benefits. If you get a certificate of rehabilitation, if it's granted, it gets sent to the governor's office because it's considered an official application for a pardon. Let's talk about really what it can do. It can help your chance of getting a professional license from a state board without a pardon. Be the official record that shows you're rehabilitated, which may improve your job or housing opportunities. And as I said before, it gets sent to the governor as an official application for a pardon. Now, here's what it does not do. It does not erase a felony conviction or seal a criminal record. California has laws for doing that. It doesn't let you say that you are, it doesn't let you say that you don't have a criminal record. This may be possible if your case was dismissed or expunged, and we've talked about this before, dismissals, reductions, and things like that. It doesn't restore your gun rights. It doesn't prevent the conviction from being considered a prior if you're convicted later of a different crime. And most importantly, as distinguished from being removed from the sex registry under PC 290.5, it does not end sex offender registration. And that's not ended unless you get relief under PC 290.5.
Chance, now, who can apply?
Yes. Who can apply? That's a good question. All right. So here's the requirements for application. One, you've got to have California residency. So there's a California registry requirement. You must have lived in California continuously for the last 5 years prior to applying. Now, it says when you go to the state site, the judicial site that puts this information out, if you don't live in California, you can always ask for a pardon. But, you know, as I've mentioned earlier, not really a good way of going. Required waiting period, at least 7 years. That's the second requirement. This is how long you have to wait before let's go back. This is how long you have to wait after you've been released from jail, prison, parole, or on probation before you can apply. This is called the period of rehabilitation. During this time, you can't get in trouble with the law, and you must make significant improvements in your life. The period of rehabilitation is generally 5 years of California, you know, generally is 5 years of California residency plus an additional few years based on your conviction. Now, in general, it's 2 to 5. The period of rehabilitation starts when you're released from jail, prison, probation, or parole, whichever happens first. And this means, in general, you can't apply unless it's been at least 7 years for most felonies. And, you know, it's got to be since you've been released from jail or prison. You can't. So you can find the wait periods in California Penal Code Section 485203 in general. If you've been convicted of a sex crime, then it's 5 years residency, 5 years rehabilitation. Okay, convictions that qualify. We spoke about this a couple of episodes ago, maybe an episode ago. Generally, only those convicted of a felony are eligible. This is in general. There are some exceptions for those who have been convicted of misdemeanor sex crime convictions. So, for those who have felony convictions and went to state or local prison, except for certain sex crimes, you must be off parole, post-release community supervision, or mandatory supervision. Those are for people, non-sex crimes, that have been convicted of a felony. For those who are placed on felony probation, except for certain sex crimes, which we'll get to, you must have your case dismissed, expunged before you can apply. You also can't have gone to jail or prison since you got your felony dismissed or be on probation for another felony. Now, the same thing applies to sex crimes. Felonies or misdemeanors involving eligible sex crimes listed in Penal Code Section 290. Same thing applies. You must have your case dismissed, which is expunged, before you can apply. You also can't have gone to jail or prison since you got your case dismissed or be on probation for another felony. Now, there are some people who can't get a certificate of rehabilitation. Those are the sex crimes where you can't get it. So if you are eligible, or you're not eligible if you are currently in the military or live out of state, also don't qualify if you are on mandatory life parole, have a death sentence, or are convicted of the following sex crimes involving a minor. And these are typically force crimes, but it's PC 269, 286C, 288, 288C, 288.5, 288.7, or 289J. If you're ineligible to apply for a certificate of rehabilitation, you can always apply for a pardon, which is going to be denied in general almost all the time. So this, in a nutshell, is what a certificate of rehabilitation is about. It's also a description of who is eligible. And next time we'll visit how it is you apply. Any questions, gentlemen?
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, And there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
I have one, but Larry, if you have one, go first.
Well, I know you said this is an automatic pipeline to the governor. It's treated as an application, but then you said that they're all denied, that you've never known anybody to get one. Just out of curiosity, do you have any idea about what percentage of these certificates for rehabilitation are granted? Is it 10%, 30%? I mean, how likely are you to be able to achieve this stuff? You got these benchmarks you're up against. What's the success rate of these?
I wish I had a breakdown to give you. They don't keep stats like that in the state. At least I've never seen them. I can tell you I've been doing this for probably, at least the last decade, if not more. And most of the ones I've prepared, and they've all involved, with the exception of maybe one, sex crimes, have all been successful. If you ask me if there's a good chance of success, there is, but a lot goes into these. They're not easy things to do. And a lot depends on who is applying for it and how they've conducted their life and how they've documented it or can get it documented so it can be put into order and submitted to the court, for review. So the answer is yes. There's always a good chance of success if you have the right stuff. The answer is, I don't know in terms of what percentage there is, but apparently it was a trickle and it was holding back the state and it was backing up the list. We have over 100,000 registrants in California. And that was one of the reasons, among others, but one of the reasons why the tiered registry came into vogue.
So, okay, Andy, go ahead.
So Chance, what if any of the professional licenses are denied when you are still under supervision before you get this certificate of rehabilitation? That's a conversation we talk about pretty regularly, about once you release from prison, how many different kinds of jobs you're prohibited from.
Well, whatever position that you're looking for that requires a license. It could be a contractor's license. It could be a license to work in the social sciences, whatever it is that requires a license. If you're not barred by the Business and Profession Code just outright, then it's probably going to be an issue with licensing. And if it's an issue with licensing, this is a very good thing to have.
Yeah, no doubt. Because people in prison will learn how to cut hair, for example, and then they go try to do that profession, and that industry's whatever regulation licensing scheme, they say, oh, well, you're a felon, you can't have a barber's license. But I did the classes while I was gone to be, anyway, seemed kind of ridiculous and counterproductive to do that.
Interesting you should say that, because, of course, this goes part and parcel with getting, if you at least have something that can be reduced within the state of California and you're eligible for it, it really helps to do that along with dismissals and stuff. But in terms of licensing and its effect on licensing, for what you're speaking to, if you're not outright barred and it becomes an issue, this is the perfect vehicle for helping you get over that hurdle.
And then the second thing, somebody kind of commented it on chat, but do people think that this certificate of rehabilitation ends their registration? Has that come up to you?
Well, in certain instances, it used to before the tiered registry. And that does come up all the time. People think that if they can't get off the tiered registry because, say, they're in tier three and they're doing life, that they can then apply for a certificate and be removed. That is just not the case, generally. Okay. Here's the caveat. If you got a pardon, you can be removed, but I've never heard of one. Okay, I've right. never heard of one happening. And so I can't really say that if you get one, you can't be removed. Yes, I mean, in the rarest circumstance, that could happen. I mean, I guess anything's possible.
And it's totally possible I wasn't completely paying attention. Who is the one that issues this certificate of rehabilitation? Is this treatment or is this probation?
No, this is the court, the state court is where you petition. So it's the court in the city you reside in, the jurisdiction you reside in. That's the court you go to, and that's who issues the certificate.
Larry, can you translate what this is to any other jurisdiction?
Not at first glance, I cannot. We have discussed wanting to model something here after California and in terms of certificate of rehabilitation. And we've not been able to get a lot of traction on it politically. The political opposition comes from the law enforcement apparatus, but also from the fear that people will come to the lax state of New Mexico to eradicate their criminal history and claim to be rehabilitated. And we just haven't been able to get any traction. So I can't think of anywhere else where they have this, but I'm sure there are other states that do.
But so this isn't your treatment provider telling you that you have been rehabilitated, and this isn't you necessarily being removed from supervision, and this isn't being removed from the registry. This is yet another thing that another mountain you're trying to climb?
No, this is a post-conviction relief mechanism when you're done with all that. And just to address what Larry said, which is interesting, you know, and I always think of reform as, you know, if you find something somewhere else that's great, cut and paste it and take it to your state and say, hey, this is only done for people who have original jurisdiction in California. For instance, if you've committed a crime anywhere else and you come to California, you're not eligible for a certificate because California is not the state of original jurisdiction. This is only for folks who get convicted within the state. This is a remedy for them. You know, just like if you got convicted within the state and you went to live somewhere else and you wanted to apply for relief under the tiered system, you know, in some states you can get relief, but you know, in California, you know, it has to do with, you know, you can come from another state and actually live in California and get relief. In this instance, for a certificate, you have to have been convicted in California first in order to be eligible for it.
Well, gotcha. We have wanted to do it broader than that because people have been convicted in other states and they've lived here 20, 30, 40 years successfully. So we've wanted to do that. But yes, Andy, this is a whole process similar to a pardon. You're applying for it and the court's granting it. So it's another thing that a person can do to show that they have been rehabilitated from their criminality, even though it doesn't erase their record. And I love it. But like I said, we can't get the political will to do it here.
Gotcha. All right. Anything else there before we go over to this talking about Weinstein again?
No, Weinstein. No, let's go.
Let's do it. I can't wait.
I know, right? Well, this is, let me get down there. We recently discussed, like two episodes, I think, in a row, we discussed Harvey Weinstein's conviction. And you want to go back to that again. In this article from the Marshall Project, it states, New York's highest court overturned Harvey Weinstein's sex crime conviction last week to cries of anguish from women despairing that the legal system lags behind the Me Too reckoning in delivering justice for survivors of sexual harassment. And Larry, you're going to tell me what your take is. So tell me your take.
Well, as the article stated, the 4-3 decision, the ruling, laid bare a separate tension plaguing criminal justice, the fear that eroding protections for defendants could hurt black and brown men, another historically harmed group. But my fear is that it will ultimately hurt all defendants because of public pressure to change the rules of evidence. We need more convictions, Andy. You don't understand this. We need more convictions.
Clearly. So remind the audience of the essence of that decision.
Well, the majority ruled that the trial judge should not have allowed testimony from women whose accounts of Weinstein's forcing sex on them were not part of the charges. In other words, they took testimony from people who were not parties to the case. They weren't witnesses to anything other than they're saying, hey, happened to me too.
Larry, it seems absolutely clear to me that you cannot understand that sex cases are often messy, frequently with no witnesses, and circumstances where women pressured to placate powerful men also had consensual nastiness with them.
I actually can understand all those points. Nonetheless, our system of justice does not and should never allow such evidence to be admissible.
You're hopeless. The central issue in these kinds of cases often come down to whether the jury believes the man or the woman. The he said, she said. There are generally no witnesses. You're hopeless.
Well, I do understand that, but it's still no different than the other criminal behavior that's been alleged. I mean, I go through this. The accuser bears the burden of establishing that a criminal act has taken place. Why do the police even bother to ask anybody about accusations when you say you've had an embezzlement of $1.4 million? Why don't they say, oh, well, we don't need to see your audit trails. We don't need to see your video. We don't need to see anything. You've lost $1 million. We'll take your word for it. The police
that
must
was an awfully specific number.
Yeah. The police must first determine that a crime has occurred. And that means that if you're saying I was sexually assaulted, we don't just automatically assume that you were sexually assaulted. We don't assume that you weren't, just like we don't assume when someone says their house was burglarized or their business was embezzled. We start getting into what evidence demonstrates that that crime occurred. And so I understand it. But if you're going to accuse somebody of something that'll put them in a cage, you got to have evidence. I'm sorry.
I remember in the Bill Cosby case, such testimony was admitted because it was intended to establish patterns that show intent and bolster women's credibility. As the article points out, Cosby's case first led to a mistrial, then a conviction, and ended with a successful appeal on different grounds.
Well, I truly don't remember the exact reasons for that Cosby's conviction was overturned. Maybe Chance does. But still, he spent years in that cage before all this was undone, and it should never have occurred the first time. I mean, they had to extinguish the rules of due process to convict Cosby.
The article quotes Elizabeth Schneider, a professor at Brooklyn Law School, saying, "Rape is a charge easy to allege and hard to prove." She said standards were hysterically based on the fear that women are going to falsely accuse men of rape. That's why rape law had so many evidentiary exceptions compared to other crimes. Some of these rules changed as attitudes shifted. Lawmakers and court decisions can alter rules of evidence. Is she correct?
Yes, she is indeed. The article also states in 1994, Congress amended federal rules to admit evidence of prior sexual assault or child molestation in some cases, said Stephen Schuhoffer, professor emeritus at New York University Law School. But that applies only in federal courts. But some states have also altered the rules of evidence, including New York, California, and Pennsylvania. More changes are likely coming in view of this decision in Weinstein's case, because the Me Too movement and these people, they're not going to roll over and say, well, we give up. They're going to put enormous pressure to make sure that anything that they deem as evidence should be admitted. That's what they're going to do.
The article then states, allowing testimony of prior accusations of harassment runs up against a fundamental legal principle that prior bad acts should not be admitted as evidence. Doing so could bias a jury against the defendant, since they're likely to believe a person will repeat past actions. Is that your fear?
It is my fear. When you start making exceptions, and Chance is a 30-year law practitioner, the exceptions begin to swallow the rule. I mean, this article also noted another example of a case where outrage over a ruling backfired and hurt vulnerable people. California voters recalling a judge who handed down a lenient sentence to Brock Turner, a Stanford swimmer accused of sexual assault. The article cited a study concluding that judges fearing a similar political outcome handed down harsher sentences in a wide range of cases, with Black and Latino men most affected.
So does protecting the rights of defendants mean that PFR-type crime survivors will be denied justice? An outspoken dissent in the Weinstein ruling by Judge Madeline Singus raises that very specter. How does the legal system balance these competing interests?
Well, in my view, there's no need to make any drastic changes. the burden appropriately belongs with the accuser to demonstrate a crime was committed, and the burden correctly rests with the prosecution to prove the allegations beyond a reasonable doubt. And they do not need to change the rules, the process, to include character assassination, which is what they did in Weinstein and Cosby's case.
I just wanted to add that someone in chat, I'm pretty sure that this sounds about right. Cosby had previously given deposition in a civil case based on previous prosecutor's promise not to charge him criminally. Then years later, a different prosecutor charged him criminally. The court ruled the state broke its promise and overturned the conviction.
Thank you.
Now, with that said, though, what's next for Mr. Weinstein?
Well, he's getting a new trial, and I think we identified a September trial date. And then also there's issues in California where his attorneys have avowed to do an appeal. I think that appeal's underway. And the California appellate judges at some level will have to face the same tensions and the same difficult choices. Are they going to give in to the mob, or are they going to do what should be done? If the same type of evidence got in California, those convictions should be overturned as well.
Do we have any comments from Chance before we move along?
Yeah, Chance is like frozen in time with this. You know, this issue is... This issue has been around for a long, long, long time. And, you know, I think that Larry's right. You know, the rule gets swallowed up by the exceptions. And I think that, you know, the push is to get it almost to the point where, you know, you just believe, you know, an allegation based on who's making it. If a woman's saying that she was assaulted, and, you know, take it as true. And, you know, that's just, it's the line's just been pushed so far. It's just incredible that we're at this point right now. And it's going to be really fascinating to see how the courts and, you know, and what the politics are here and how the thing shapes out. But so far and where we are in time right now, it's not great.
Well, then the final article to close out the evening is from Reason Magazine. Boy, this is one of my favorite magazines. Minnesota's indefinite detention as PFR offenders is ineffective as well as unjust. According to the article, Minnesota's indefinite detention of PFRs is ineffective as well as unjust. A new report argues that the notorious program squanders taxpayer money while keeping people in prison without justification or recourse. What do you want to say about this, other than it's not right?
Well, a lot. We've got to have time, but Minnesota's Sexually Dangerous Person Act was enacted in 1994, and it authorized civil commitment of anyone who has engaged in a course of harmful sexual conduct, has manifested a sexual, personality, or other mental disorder dysfunction, and as a result is likely to engage in acts of harmful sexual conduct. Now, that is so broad, I can't even describe what you could drive through that definition of likely to engage in acts of harmful sexual conduct. What does that mean, Chance? You're a lawyer. What does that mean, making obscene telephone calls? Does that mean
That means get on the train, because everybody's going to the same place. That's what it means.
So,
since you were asking about how big of a whatever you could drive through it, there was a solar flare that hit the Earth. I think it was last night, and it was like I think 15 times the size of Earth. So perhaps you could drive that through that hole.
So,
yeah.
And I'll put this in here because we don't do enough about civil commitment. We don't talk about it as much as we should. It's one of those things where I have a little hope that we can eradicate it. I think we can contain some of the excesses in it, but sex offender civil commitment is morally repugnant and it violates everything about our due process. But the Supreme Court has upheld it, and it's not likely to change unless we can muster the political will. But go ahead.
And how is this different, though, from standard civil commitment?
Well, the biggest difference is the standard for commitment is so much lower than regular civil commitment process. And then the standard in a regular civil commitment process is they want to get you out. And this, they want to keep you in. But in regular civil commitment, the goal is to rehabilitate the person and get them out of the institution, including people like John Hinckley, who shot the president along with four others.
Sure. And how many states have this practice?
According to the story, 20 states authorize civil commitment of PFRs who have completed their criminal sentences but are deemed too dangerous for release. Minnesota, which deploys that option against a larger share of its population than any other state, spends $100 million a year to detain about 750 individuals who are deemed likely to commit sex offenses.
As of last September, just 21 of 946 people committed in the Minnesota's sex offender program, MSOP, had been fully discharged, while 94, more than four times as many, had died in custody. Why is that nobody is released from this?
Well, because I said just before, that's not the goal, which is what the goal should be, which take away someone's liberty civilly. It's only for no longer than necessary with the goal. But the MSOP program, which is overseen by the Minnesota Department of Human Services, imposes life sentences on its clients, not as punishment for crimes they've committed, because they've already served that, but anticipation of any crimes they might commit in the future, which is against everything this country stands for. We don't preventatively detain people for something that they might do.
You know, Larry, I'm going to ask Chance this, because I know your answer is no. But Chance, have you ever seen the movie Minority Report?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have. And that's what Larry's describing right there.
Yes, it is. It's thought crime. If you possibly would think of the crime that you might go do it, then they have these three people suspended in water, and they will tell you, they will tell the police to go arrest you. And so minutes before you go commit the crime, you get arrested for thought crime.
Yeah, the only difference here is that they're not suspended in water. They're, you know, they're suspended on ice. It's Minnesota.
Right, that's true. The article states civil commitment's reduction of sexual violence is vanishingly small compared to its expense, says the report from Mitchell Hamline's Sex Offense Litigation and Policy Resource Center, which notes that it costs about $175,000 a year to keep each detainee in the program. Because civil commitment focuses on preventing a small fraction of recidivist offenses, law professor Eric Janis and his co-authors argue, it neither addresses nor repairs the vast majority of sexual harm in Minnesota.
Did you just say $175,000 per detainee per year?
I did. Yes, $175,000.
Now that's funny. Can you admit that?
That's a lot of simoleons. No, it's not funny. $175,000 and there's 946 people in there now, or is that the 946 have been there?
Not clear on that, but that is a very expensive operation to run at nearly $200,000 per guest.
Per guest. And I'm sure they don't get like cleaning, house cleaning, and room service. I always thought that the facilities were more like hospital settings. It appears that they're not. Officially, the MSOP's locked facilities in Moose Lake and St. Peter, both of which have secure perimeters, fenced by razor wire, are treatment centers, not prisons. Civil commitment, nevertheless, is subject to several constitutional requirements. To be committed, an individual must have a mental disorder that makes him dangerous to himself or others. In the case of PFRs, that mental disorder must distinguish people subject to commitment from others convicted of similar crimes. The program must provide treatment when it is feasible, and the nature and duration of commitment must bear a reasonable relationship to the purpose of the commitment. The MSOP falls short on all accounts.
I definitely agree with that. I've been shocked that this, I mean, we get into, hopefully we have time, but I mean, this has been declared unconstitutional by a trial judge, and then it was overturned by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. But anyway, keep going.
All right. I did miss a line there, though, but we're good. The article states that abdication of responsibility jibes with the attitude of Minnesota's political leaders. Even while defending the MSOP in 2015, then-Governor Mark Dayton conceded that civil commitment decisions are no better than guesswork, because it's really impossible to predict whether or not PFRs are at risk to reoffend. As Dayton saw, the solution was to err on the side of keeping everyone locked up. Larry, if we follow that approach, then pretty much everyone would be in jail, because probably everyone has committed something along the way.
Correct.
And that was consistent with the position of Dayton's predecessor, Tim Pawlenty, took in 2003 when he issued an executive order barring the release of an MSOP detainees unless required by law or ordered by a court.
So sad. In practice, each detainee has the burden of petitioning for transfer or release, and that process is plagued by bottlenecks, redundant reviews, and backlogs. MSOP detainees wait an average of 625 days, which is nearly 2 years, for a final decision to be made on their petitions to transfer to a less restrictive environment or to be discharged. And that's according to Professor Janus.
Where did I go?
Right here.
Oh, that's okay. The article, sorry. Yeah. The article pointed out, there's a tornado warning like they've been cited in my area. The article pointed out that until 2015, when a federal judge deemed the MSOP unconstitutional, no detainee had ever been fully discharged, even though the program at that point had been operating for 2 decades. Since that time, a slow trickle has begun, but releases are still outpaced by deaths in custody. As of September, nearly 3/4 of MSOP clients had been detained for more than a decade, nearly half for more than 15, and about a fifth for more than 2 decades. God.
Now, before I get to my script, now think about that. Think about this. You served all of your time, and then a few months before you're going to be released from prison, they hit you with this petition. You've served 10, 15, or 20 years in this shadow prison. On top of that, with no hope of getting out, you're going to die there. But the funny thing is, as the article stated, running parallel to civil commitment expansion over the last 3 decades, Minnesota has also increased criminal sentences and post-confinement supervision for those convicted of sex offenses. For example, the average sentence for first-degree criminal sexual conduct increased from 75 months in 1988 to 190 months in 2017. Ooh. Minnesota and many states have gone to the extremes when it comes to sentencing for sexual offenses. Folks, elections have consequences. I can't say this enough. When you go to vote and they tell you that they're going to impose harsher penalties, but they're running on that platform, please take them at their word. This shows you what you've been voting for since 1988. They've mostly all promised you longer sentences, and you see they've kept that promise.
Without a doubt. I'm just going to assert that for the people to be placed in these facilities, these aren't people that flashed running down the street, I'm assuming. These are people that did a significant amount of time before they got to this stage.
Correct. That is what's so tragic about it. If we really had some concern about how dangerous they were and that they might reoffend, we would have actually treated them in the 10, 15, 20, or 30 years they were in prison previously.
Yeah, wouldn't that be a better approach, that from day one that they walk in the door, that there are treatment classes, mental retraining, thought process, critical thinking, all that stuff to try and keep people from doing terrible things when they get out?
Depends what your philosophy is. I mean, if your state philosophy is that folks that commit these kinds of crimes can never be rehabilitated, and you've got the Roach Hotel approach, which is what this is. If you think that there's hope and that you can make a difference and people can transcend and be reintegrated, you've got a different program. And, you know, Larry's absolutely right. You know, your vote counts.
So.
But in comparison of us to other nations, we'll stick with Western-ish type nations. I'm assuming that Americans aren't like that much more deranged, and they aren't doing these kinds of things to us people.
Well, they take a different attitude in other nations about the longevity, the length of sentences. When you talk to a European, they're shocked that we believe in putting people in prison for so many years. The attention getting and the effectiveness of prison diminishes the longer the person stays there because they become institutionalized. You could get a person's attention completely with not imposing 20, 30, 40 years of time. But Americans want to see, we're bloodthirsty. We want to see punishment and suffering. I mean, you just look at the states that don't even air condition their prison facilities in the South, particularly Florida, Alabama, Texas. They want them to suffer and be miserable. That makes Americans very happy.
I meant to send it to you, Larry and Chance, but I found on Reddit there's a Data is Beautiful is one of the subreddits, and there was one about how much the states spend on prisons, and you know, it was just like a colored graph, and the southern states were all like, they weren't zero, but they were 30 or 40, whatever the bottom of the graph was, and things got more expensive as they went into other areas. I don't want to call it red versus blue, Larry, but I think it was, you could almost overlay some pigments of red and blue over that map, and they would be, there'd be a good correlation between those two.
Well, there would be, but it's more conservative versus liberal. There was a time when Republicans were very liberal, particularly the Northeastern Republicans, so I prefer to keep it nonpartisan, and it's a philosophy rather than a party.
All right, we're going to have to discuss one day where those two things are actually different, because I would kind of call them being roughly the same thing.
They are now, but they haven't always been.
I see. Because you would have, like, whatever they're called, the Blue Dog Democrats that were more right-leaning Democrats? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, we had very conservative Democrats and very progressive Republicans at one time.
Gotcha. Anything else, gentlemen, before we head out?
That looks like that's it. That looks like that's it.
Chance, what's your phone number?
It is 949-365-5842.
And are you restricting to only talk to the California type people?
I will talk to anybody who calls. And if they can't reach me on that, leave a message. I will get to them.
And you have a vast staff and some lackey intern will call them, or will it be you?
I have people waiting by the phones this very moment.
Well, very good. Gentlemen, I hope you have a great night, great weekend. Thank you for joining this week's episode of Registry Matters. Larry, hope you have a great night and stay not so busy, man. And I'll talk to you soon.
Good night.
Take care, Chance.
You too. Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.